This is Viewpoint with attorney and author Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is a one-hour talk show confronting the issues of America's heart and home. And now with today's edition of Viewpoint, here is Chuck Crismeyer.
They were called the Los Angeles Riots in 1992, the very year that the Lord spoke to my heart in my office in Southern California, saying, "Son, you've been pleading the cause of men long enough. I want you to plead my cause in the land as a voice to the church, declaring vision for the nation, America's greatest crisis hour." Well, interestingly, 1992, May 1st, was one of the most colorful years in American history. It really was. Time magazine, I have the cover right in front of me here. "Can we all get along?" Well, that was the cry of Rodney King, who came into the fore as a result of a confrontation with police officers. And the whole county of Los Angeles, certainly the city of Los Angeles, felt the reverberations of it after a jury acquitted four officers of the Los Angeles Police Department charged with using excessive force in arresting and beating of Rodney King. So Rodney King cries out, "Can't we all get along?" Well, since that time, that cry has echoed across America, "Can't we all get along?" The problem is that there have been very little efforts to really get along. In fact, there's been an exacerbation of at least the problem of racism since then. So whatever happened to the concept, and I'm calling it the concept of color blindness, whatever happened to it? Wasn't that really at the heart of the goal of what it meant to be an American, that race and color and all of these things were secondary to becoming an American citizen, because it was the fact that we were Americans that were going to bind us together. The same was true for those who confessed Jesus Christ as Savior. It was Christ and the blood of Christ that would constrain us and that would unite us. So why is it that on any given Sunday morning, we have the most divided congregations, the most divided situation in America? White, black congregations, it still exists. Whatever happened to the virtue of colorblindness? And is it just that birds of a feather flock together? Is that the only issue that we're dealing with? Or is there something else, something as a matter of the heart, that we need to deal with? So I welcome you to Viewpoint. I'm Chuck Crismeyer. It's conversation, as always, with ever-increasing conviction, talk that transforms. And a number of years ago, as many of you know, I wrote a book called Renewing the Soul of America. It was endorsed by 38 national Christian leaders, including white and black. That's right. And here's what I wrote in a section called Racism, Rhetoric, and Reconciliation. "Racism is a reality. It has no place in our civil body politic and is repugnant to our covenant with God and our fellow man. But fundamentally, racism is not a problem that can be remedied by legislation or litigation. It can only be accomplished by heart surgery. And there's only one qualified for such surgery, and that's the great physician. Liberal demands, confrontation, and stridency serve no ultimate purpose and only provide a national excuse to drive the roots of racism deeper. On the other hand, conservative games of let's pretend that racism is neither real nor rampant only exacerbate the frenzy of strident activists. So where does that leave us?" That's the question lurking before us here today on Viewpoint. And again, I'm so glad that you've joined us. Conversation is always with ever-increasing conviction, talk that transforms. Today on Viewpoint, we have a special guest. I've never met him before. We're meeting for the first time here on air. His name is Andre Archie, and he's written a book called The Virtue of Color Blindness. The Virtue of Color Blindness. Now, here's the problem with the title of the book. Andre, I'm not criticizing the title. I think it's great. But here's the problem. The problem is that in 1972, I believe it was, Forbes magazine, actually it was 92, Forbes magazine came out with the 75th anniversary edition of its magazine. It was a huge magazine, about half an inch thick, and the whole magazine was devoted to this question: whatever happened to virtue in America? So if we talk about the virtue of colorblindness, we're assuming that there is such a thing, that there is virtue, and virtue has become almost a four-letter word in our country today. So how do we even begin talking about the virtue of colorblindness? That's just kind of an overarching question. And so Andre Archie joining us with a very important book, The Virtue of Colorblindness. Andre, it's good to have you on the program.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And that's a really important question that you asked. Now, virtue does exist. It means excellence.
Well, the Bible says that virtue exists. It says that we should add to our faith virtue. So if we're to add to our faith virtue, it must exist. So why is it we pretend that it doesn't exist?
Yeah, because we were fallen. And because of that, we have a tendency to do what we think is right, but in fact is not right. And so you mentioned Rodney King. We can mention George Floyd. Each of those events were awful. But the people that exploit those events, they're multiplying, as you've mentioned. They're multiplying.
Exactly.
And so we need to rediscover that tradition in which we're judging people according to the content of their character, not by the color of their skin.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. Believe it or not, it may seem strange, but I sit here as a lily white guy, and I have four grandchildren, my oldest grandchildren, who are all black, and their father is black as the ace of spades. He was he was the son of a chief in Ghana, and he and his family are dear to us, and they have a very hard time comprehending why all this struggle, what is this about? After all, racism existed all over Africa. It's called tribalism.
Great.
And every tribe had to be better than the next one, and there was pride in your tribe. And so you had all of that kind of strife that actually resulted in the slavery that came to America and that went to the Caribbean and that went all over Europe. So it's like we can't even acknowledge the reality of history. Why is that?
That's right. And we can't acknowledge it because groups, individuals benefit.
Oh, in other words, we're using racism or race, we're using it for ulterior motives.
Exactly.
Ah. See, when we start asking the why questions, we start getting the answers. So if we're using it for ulterior motives, then the biggest problem is the motives that are creating or exacerbating the problem.
That's right. Exactly. And we have to call those individuals out. We have to call those institutions out because they've made things so much worse.
Dramatically worse. We're going to talk about that when we get back, friends. You're going to want to get a copy of this book, The Virtue of Colorblindness. This man is daring to tell the truth, daring to confront something that few are willing to touch with a 10-foot pole. The Virtue of Colorblindness. $15 is going to put the book in your hands. It's on our website, saveus.org.
Once upon a time, children could pray and read their Bibles in school. Divorces were practically unknown, as was child abuse. In our once great America, virginity and chastity were popular virtues and homosexuality was an abomination.
So what happened in just one generation?
Hi, I'm Chuck Crismeyer, and I urge you to join me daily on Viewpoint, where we discuss the most challenging issues touching our hearts and homes. Could America's moral slide relate to the Fourth Commandment?
Listen to Viewpoint on this radio station or anytime at saveus.org.
The United States of America is at a crossroads, as our guest, when it comes to race relations. As a country nearly 245 years old, we have, through fits and starts, navigated issues of race and identity, as well as could be expected given the tension brought about by our founding documents and their principles and the institution of slavery on our shores. But through it all, we've stayed true to the spirit of 1776 and 1863 by recognizing individual rights, not group rights. The American Project extols the individual, not the group. And Americans intuitively know it's morally right to judge individuals based on their character and not their race. In other words, Americans know it's morally right to be colorblind. Due to guilt, though, Americans seem to have been lulled and intimidated into equating the colorblind approach to race relations to a type of colorblind racism, an unfortunate occurrence, and portends a dim future for the United States if left unchecked. I agree with that wholeheartedly. The heart of this preface that you have written, Andre, is the word moral. The word moral. Americans know it's morally right to be colorblind, but it apparently we don't even comprehend the word moral or have redefined it to mean something immoral. What do you say to this issue of morality?
Yeah, I think morality, it goes to the key, the heart of the issue of race and racism in America. And the idea of colorblindness, it includes three things. It includes a strong national identity, a strong family, and a solid education. High school education doesn't have to be, some PhD or master's, you know.
Right.
And so when you think about those three and how they support colorblindness, it becomes essential that we talk about morality, because our founding document, the project of what it is to be an American, is to believe in a certain set of values, which are informed in a lot of cases by the Bible. But it's not limited to the Bible. It also takes into account the Western philosophical tradition.
Right.
But morality is a key part of what will get us back to that tradition of judging others according to their character.
But today it seems like the word morality is being redefined as whatever serves my personal or group interests, not what is pleasing to God, our Creator, and what is in the best interests of we the people. So it's not we the people anymore. It's we the divided people. It's we the blacks, or we the colored people, or we the Hispanics, or we something else, we the women. It's like we have intentionally divided ourselves since the late 1960s into all of these divisions. And interestingly, it's the same group, the same politically viewpoint that has created all the division. They're all based upon liberal politics in order to gain more and more power and control. That's how I see it, and going all the way back into the 1960s. So if that be the case, how are we going to solve this problem when those in political leadership in a half-divided country are intent on keeping that division going?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I try to address some of that in the book, but it's not morality that you're describing, or at least the opponents that are opposed to colorblindness. That's relativism.
I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying.
That's right. It's been dangerous. It's a part of postmodernism. Nothing is objective. It all depends on how you feel and whether or not you feel comfortable. But that attitude, that philosophy has gotten us into the problem that we find ourselves. And so what can we do when we have a country that's evenly divided or supposedly evenly divided? We have to start speaking up. That's probably the most profound bit of advice that I give in the book, is that we have to speak up. Parents have to speak up. We have to stop sending our children to certain schools that advocate these ideas. And nothing's going to change if we stay silent. So I would say that tradition that I refer to as being a part of that colorblind tradition, that's one in which we have to speak up and we have to defend to our neighbors at the dinner table, at our block parties, in neighborhoods. That's the only way that we're going to rediscover that concept of morality that defines who we are as Americans.
In other words, that all people were created equal because they're made by their Creator. And if you notice, have you noticed that the very group of people, both politically and otherwise, that are driving the racial agenda into disharmony are also the ones that are driving the exploding anti-Semitism.
Oh, you're absolutely right. They're the same people. They're the same people.
In other words, they have ulterior motives, and it has nothing to do with caring for people. It has everything to do with driving an agenda calculated to preserving and protecting and gaining more power.
Exactly. Exactly. And they're anti-American. They're anti-American when it comes down to it.
Exactly.
They don't believe in what we believe in. They say they do, but ultimately they don't believe in the core principles of America, which are not divisive. We fought long fights, hard fights to get where we are.
Well, so you're a professor, associate professor at Colorado State University, and you would think that given what's going on, the dynamics in American life and in our universities, you would definitely be the odd man out there.
Yeah, I mean, I am.
Book like this, you would definitely be the odd man out.
I am, and...
It's called being persecuted for righteousness' sake, Andre.
Right, right. But my colleagues that I work with are wonderful. They're committed to intellectual diversity, and so I hope it continues that way. But you're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, there are some individuals in the university that will not talk to me, but that's fine. That's fine. I think that I have right on my side.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. You do. You have God on your side, too, and that's even more right. You know, in Jesus Christ, there's neither black nor white, bond nor free, male nor female, but all are united in Christ as one blood in Christ. And in America, that concept was foundational to the very idea set forth, the very cultural greater idea of American, that we're all in this together and we'll be identified by our unified beliefs, our unified culture that was rooted in the gospel of Jesus Christ. But we are a long way away from that now, a long way away. And here's a guy by the name of Frederick Douglass who says, I am black, dyed-in-the-wool Republican, and I never intend to belong to any other party than the Party of Freedom, the Republican Party. How could he possibly say something so antithetical to everything that's promoted by the Democrat Party today?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating story, the evolution of Frederick Douglass, but he was under the influence of Garrison, William Lloyd Garrison, who thought the United States and what it stood for was absolutely evil. And the difference over time is that Douglass came to realize that it was our founding document and the Western philosophical tradition, the Christian tradition, that could be read in a certain way that animated these American founding documents. And he said, well, that's the healthiest and the best course to follow. And so he evolved over time, and he came to embrace our founding documents, the American project, the fact that we're all equal before the eyes of God, in addition to the eyes of the law, right? So the law is blind. We see everyone as having a soul and that having capability and the capacity to exercise their reason. So Frederick Douglass appreciated this after having done a lot of study.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very influential in terms of Lincoln, right? Lincoln listened to Douglass. You know, Douglass wasn't a politician, but I mean, he was sort of a moral gadfly, if you will. And I think that was quite powerful. So it's that tradition that I'm trying to reanimate.
Uh-huh.
Because a lot of people just don't recognize that that tradition is the very tradition that MLK appeals to in 1963 during his march on Washington.
It's true. So and isn't it interesting, though, that by 1964, it was only because of the Republicans that this 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed. because right. Democrats resisted it.
That's right. That's right.
So
and people have to be reminded of that.
It's unbelievable because the resistance for racial equality and equity has always come from the Democrat Party, historically.
That's right. Yep, and it continues.
And it continues because it's a new form of slavery, a form of slavery that uses the black community as the engine to preserve power against the rest of the country.
That's right. That's right. And that's the part that it's difficult for people to acknowledge that. It's difficult for people to acknowledge that.
Wouldn't you say that's a pretty big deal then that's lurking in our election coming up in about 40 days?
Oh, of course. Of course. And of course, the Democrats are exploiting that to the utmost. And there's going to be a lot of Americans who buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And we can only hope.
A lot of white Americans who are going to buy it.
That's right.
Why?
That's right. I can't look into their hearts, but all I can say is that maybe they're ignorant. They just don't understand.
Or maybe it's an emotional ploy that has been superimposed upon white Americans that somehow your very whiteness is responsible for all the division in America. What say you?
That's probably correct. I mean, I have students who feel that way. They tell me.
Okay, so that brings us to a whole group of folk that you talk about in your book, the group of people who actually have been driving these kinds of things, like Derek Bell, the critical race theory, CRT, that's made its way even into the folds of the Southern Baptist Convention.
Right, yeah. It's very unfortunate, and it's very dangerous.
Why is it so dangerous, though?
It's dangerous because of what you just mentioned. If you can have a person like Derek Bell, who essentially, he argues a couple of things, but the most important and the most divisive is that he says racism is ordinary. It's not aberrational. It's ordinary. People are naturally racist. And if that's the case, then people of color will never get a fair break because racism is systemic. It's everywhere.
All right. So what about people with red hair? That's systemic, too. There may not be as many of them, but it's systemic because they have red hair. And by definition, if you don't have red hair, you are, shall we say, color racist against people with red hair. So every division, by definition of critical race theory, every division or identifiable difference between people is cause for multiplying that division and claiming that we can never come together.
That's right. That's right. But there's more white people than there are redheads. And so if you have a group of people who presumably have all the power, it's those people you want to believe, you want them to believe that, yes, America is systemically racist. So not only is it on the outside, but you're having them believe it about themselves, which is we talk about colonization. When you colonize someone's way of thinking about themselves, that goes deep, right? If you have someone white saying, I'm systemically racist, I might not be aware of my actions, I'm a very nice person, but still, by the mere fact that I exist, I'm being systemically racist. I mean, if a person believes that, that is pretty deep. I mean, these ideas have gotten so far into the body politic that we have individuals who are completely innocent. They try to do the right thing, but they believe that they're bad and evil.
Yeah.
And that's where CRT it's gained some victories.
In other words, the unforgivable sin.
That's right.
Your color is the unforgivable sin. You were born that way, and you can never repent. You can never be delivered from such sin. Therefore, you are the odd man out and must be severed from society. Wow.
Right.
Friends, we're talking straight talk for troubled times, the virtue of color blindness. Got to get a copy of the book, friends. We'll be right back.
There is so much more about Chuck Chrismeyer and Save America Ministries.
on our website, saveus.org. For example, under the marriage section, God has marriage on his mind. Chuck has some great resources to strengthen your marriage. First off, a fact sheet on the state of the marital union, a fact sheet on the state of ministry, marriage, and morals. SaveUS.org. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage. What does the Bible really teach about this? Find all of this at SaveUS.org. Also, a letter to pastors, the Hosea Project, SaveUS.org, and many more resources to strengthen your marriage. It's all on Chuck's website, saveus.org. Again, you can listen to Chuck's Viewpoint broadcast live and archived. Save America Ministries website at saveus.org.
Welcome back to Viewpoint, friends. We're having an honest conversation, straightforward, breaching through the barriers of our time. The cultural mandates, political correctness, multiculturalism, religious pluralism, and all those things that are the unholy trinity dividing we the people and dividing the world from Christ himself. The title of this book, The Virtue of Colorblindness, Andre Archie, the guest today and the author. It's a $30 book. Actually, it's yours for $15 on our, my secretary tells me it's $15, so that's what I'm going to say. Right there on our website, saveus.org, you can give us a call at 1-800-SAVE-USA, 1-800-SAVE-USA, or write to us at Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Writing a check at $6 for postage and handling. This is a hardbound book, by the way. Now, here is a conundrum, Andre, and you talk about the virtue of color blindness. However, when the reality is that when I look at your picture, I see a dark skin, so I see color. I see the color of your jacket in this picture as blue. You have a light blue shirt on. You have white teeth and white eyes. And so we see color everywhere we go. So when you say colorblind, what do we really mean by that? Do we mean not being able to see color? Or do we mean something else?
Well, we mean something else. I mean, of course, we see people's color. You know, if you're a visible minority, you're a person of color, you might be of Asian descent. But, I mean, it's clear that in the case of people of color, that their skin is brown or dark or whatever. So I don't mean that.
Well, let me tell you, my son-in-law's skin was so dark that when my daughter brought him home on Christmas Eve, 30-some years ago, to present him to us, it was at nighttime, and came to the front porch, and she stood there, lily white, and she said, I want you to meet Michael. And we looked around, and we didn't see Michael until he smiled. That's the only time we could see Michael, because then his white teeth showed, because he was in deep shadows, and he's so dark that we couldn't see his color. So maybe if things were dark enough, we wouldn't be able to see color, and we'd see the smile, and that would be a good thing, wouldn't it?
Well, of course it would be a good thing. But you know, I mean, we can, you know, it. And the story that you tell is powerful because, I mean, you know, people come in different shape, and that's perfectly fine. We can't ignore it. We shouldn't ignore it. There's no reason to ignore it. But the issue is, what do we associate with that color? Do we see people of color as being victims? And do we see people who are not of color? Do we see white people as being victimizers? That's what I mean by being colorblind.
Okay. So it's a matter of the choices that we attribute, the values that we attribute to such people. And, of course, that brings the whole idea of what do they call it when a police officer is prone, more prone, say, to arrest a black man than a white man?
Right.
What do we call that?
Racial profiling.
Racial profiling. Now, there's a reason for that. The reason is not the color of the skin. It's the behavior of those with that skin color as a general pattern. And we form that kind of idea with everybody.
That's right. That's right.
You
and,
know?
And cultures are not all the same. I mean, that's just a fact. And I talk a little bit about this. You know, people like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Kendi try to deny this. But, I mean, cultures aren't. I mean, there's good and bad aspects to cultures.
True.
And so if you have a group of people, a group of young people, young black males, let's say, for whatever reason, I get into this regarding the family and the lack of fathers. But
and we're going to talk about that in the last segment of the program here.
Right. So, I mean, there are certain behaviors that get associated with groups. And the fact is, we just have to be honest and say, you know, it's not the color, but it's the behavior.
Yeah,
that gets associated with the color because there's a pattern, there's probability there, there's statistics there, and in a lot of cases it's unfortunate, but you can't deny it.
Well, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a Democrat back in 1965, talked about what was happening in the black family. He said, "We're actually defining deviancy down. If we don't get a hold of what's happening in the black family, this country is going to come apart." At the scenes. That was a Democrat senator writing in 1965, the year after the Civil Rights Action. So this has been a problem that we should have seen coming, but instead of seeing it coming and do something about it in the area of the family, we chose to name call, to divide further, to create accusations, CRT, and all of these kinds of things that prevented us from actually dealing with lots of the root problems. And we want to talk about the family situation shortly in the final segment of the program. But who is this Ibram Kendi? What's he all about? We hear about him all the time.
Yeah, Ibram Kendi, he's, if I'm not mistaken, he's still at the University of Boston. He was written about recently. There was some funds that went to his center that can't or couldn't be accounted for. I don't think they're going to really tell us what happened because, you know, he's a pretty protected person.
Mm-hmm.
But he's filled with, I can say, racist ideas. I mean, if you've read anything he's written, it's just been over the top and clearly racist. And so here's an individual who's been very influential. He talks about the anti-racist baby. He's the individual, by the way, that coined the term anti-racism. And so when you hear that concept, just think about the idea that, first of all, America is systemically racist, and that if blacks are not equal in terms of what they have, in terms of outcomes of what they have with whites, then automatically, by definition, there's racism there.
Right.
And so he says any sort of inequality, any sort that you find between blacks and whites, it has to be remedied through law. We have to discriminate for the sake of making African Americans.
And all of the, out of all of that comes the increasing cry for reparations, right?
That's right. That's right. That's
okay.
The justification.
Okay. This is a very the very moment you say you're anti-racist is the moment you're considered the most racist from Mr. Kendi's view, right?
That's right, because you can't be neutral.
So you yourself are the object of his scorn because the very concept of virtue of colorblindness is impossible to him.
That's right. It's colorblind racism. That's his position.
Wow. How do you ever get out of such a conundrum? You talk about deception.
Yep.
Who's the deceiver? The Bible says that the deceiver is Satan himself. It appears to me that he is very active, and is seeking to divide off our country. And for what reason, you wonder? For what reason? Well, divide and conquer.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And him in particular, he's an entrepreneur. You know, he's very clever. He's written books for young parents, the anti-racist baby. He's written curricula for colleges, high schools. He's gotten into the body politic so much so that many of the ideas that we associate with CRT, it's Ibram X. Kendi.
Yeah.
It's this idea of anti-racism, and it's from the top to the bottom. It's revolutionized our institutions in terms of taking us back and having us focus on race.
And then, of course, you have another personality in there that's not quite of that ilk, but Robin DiAngelo. That is also one of the trilogy here of the racism promoters, ideologies of racism. And these people are honored, they're revered, they're promoted primarily within the Democrat Party. And that's where they get their power. That's where they get their underwriting. That's where they sell their books. And so it's no wonder that we have a nation that is almost equally divided, red states and blue states, would you say?
Yes, I would say you're absolutely right. I mean, she represents what are called diversity trainers. They're trying to change the name now, but they're just as awful in terms of having a focus on race.
Have you noticed, Andre, that there is a growing trend, though, among a number of corporations to shed the DEI approach because it's so divisive even in their own companies?
That's right. And that's the thing. We start speaking up. We start pushing back. A lot of these companies, in fact, a lot of these higher education institutions, will acquiesce because they're not principled. And so, once you start pushing back, and you get a large number of people pushing back, they acquiesce. And so we have to appreciate that. We need to start speaking up because, like I said, people know what's right. I think when it comes down to it, we know what's right. And we know that it's wrong to discriminate.
So why do we so easily capitulate? Because we're sinners. Is that it?
It's because we're sinners.
Okay.
And it's because we're not informed.
Okay.
We're not informed.
All right. Well, today we're informing about the virtue of color blindness. Not that we can't see color, but that we don't hold color to be the final determiner of value in our lives, because we realize that God made us all. We're all the descendants of Noah. We're all the descendants of Noah. And Noah was the descendant of Adam and Eve. So, friends, look, we've got to stop playing this game, this pretend game of racial division. It's ungodly. It's not only unconstitutional, it's ungodly. That's the reason we need to come against it. It's nothing. There is no value that comes from it, only division. And who's the agent of division? I don't have to ask you, because you know, Satan himself. We'll be right back after this. The book, The Virtue of Colorblindness, a $30 book for $15, on our website, saveus.org. Write to us, call us. We'll be right back.
Have you ever considered what the early church was like? Many people are developing a heart longing for a greater fulfillment in our practices as Christians. A recent study showed 53,000 people a week are leaving the back door of America's churches in frustration. What is going on? Why has there not been even a 1% gain among followers of Christ in the last 25 years? Could it be that God is seeking to restore first century Christianity for the 21st century? Jesus said, "I'll build my church." Is Christ by his Spirit stirring to prepare the church for the 21st century? The early church prayed together and broke bread from house to house. They were family, and it was said by all who observed, "Behold how they love one another." Incredible.
But the same can be found right now. Go to saveus.org and click Sell Church. We can revive first century Christianity for the 21st century.
It's about people, not programs. It's about a body, not a building.
That's saveus.org. Click Sell Church.
Welcome back to Viewpoint. I'm Chuck Chrismeyer. An article came out a few years ago called The Decline of the African-American Family. Here I read some excerpts. Race in America is set against the backdrop of horrible historical realities. Racism is the normal explanation for the decline of the black family. But that analysis doesn't hold up. Thomas Sowell has shown that the black family survived centuries of slavery and generations of Jim Crow, where most black children grew up in homes with two parents. In fact, when blacks were just one generation out of slavery, the census data that era showed that the slightly higher percentage of black adults had married than white adults. In 1950, 72% of all black men and 81% of black women had been married. In 1965, 76% of black children were born to married women. Now, 72% of black children are born to unmarried women. What do you make of that, and what does it have to say about this problem of racial division in the country? Can't we all get along? Apparently, within the black family, the answer is no. So that other articles say that black women hold black men in suspicion because they can't trust their sexual proclivities. I have it all in files, my friend. What's going on? What is the answer to this dilemma? Can we continue to play the race card and DEI and CRT and all of this stuff when we have a situation where a leader, in fact, it came out in Ebony magazine a few years back. The leader, a spokesman for Ebony magazine, said that the breakdown of the black family had occurred more in the last 14 generations than it had, more in the last 14 years, he said, than in the 14 decades since slavery. What do you make of that? Something is going on, and it's driving greater and greater division and animosity within the black community, such as to buy into the CRT and the Ibram and all of these people.
Yeah, I think that it's a very important topic. And you mentioned Moynihan. E. Franklin Frazier, a black sociologist in the 60s, 70s, wrote about some of these trends.
Uh-huh.
And you're absolutely right. You know, the black family was compared to today, was quite stable. And then once you got up to the 60s and then on, you start seeing the breakdown of the black family. And now it's, like as you mentioned, 71% of black children are born to single parents.
Well, that was promoted by Lyndon Baines Johnson coming out in 1964 in the Civil Rights Act. It was used by the Democrat Party to actually create a worse situation by creating terrible financial problems, urging immorality, saying that we're going to provide black mothers with government money if you'll have babies but not have the father in the home.
Yeah. No,
that's what he conceived to do.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And, Goldwater had his issues. But one thing that he pointed out, during the time that the civil rights, 1960 civil rights bill was being debated, is that you're going to have government overreaching.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have government doing things that are just illegitimate in terms of providing for the family when the father should provide for the family. And that's exactly what happened.
Well, if you don't have a father in the home, in fact, lately, I'd say in the last 10 years, most of the observations sociologically within our country have been that fatherlessness is the number one cause of almost all of the other social issues in our country. Fatherlessness. And guess where the predominance of fatherlessness is? In the black community.
That's right. That's right. And I think that it's the key. It's the key. I'm not sure if I have any solutions regarding fatherlessness, but I know that it makes young black children susceptible to a lot of these ideas, CRT, systemic racism, anti-racism. Because if you're groping for an identity, if you're trying to figure out who am I, you've already missed out on one pillar. Mm-hmm. You don't have a father who's telling you, you know, this is who you are. This is who we are as a family.
Yeah.
And so you're sort of groping for it. You know,
so the government becomes your pseudo-father.
That's right. That's right. Mom's working hard, but mom can't be both mother and father. And so the government steps in. The government steps in. And, of course, it makes things so much worse. Wow. And it creates a mentality, a mindset, that I think a lot of young black children, and you're starting to see it with white families.
All right. Is it racism that resulted in Walter Williams, a black columnist, writing that fully 85% of all black children in poverty live in single-parent mother-child homes? Is that racism?
No.
No, it's not racism at all. It's the lack of the father in the home.
That's right. That's right.
And sexual promiscuity.
And when you have that, when you don't have a structure, a stable family, not a perfect family, but a stable family,
mm-hmm.
teaching children to delay gratification, providing a sense of belonging, a sense of a higher power. When you don't have that, you have these proclivities. You have this sort of behavior. You have basically young people looking for, who am I? Looking for an identity. And a racial identity is easy to sort of glob onto. And that's what you get with a birth rate that is one in which children are being bred in families that there's only one parent. You get all sorts of destructive behaviors.
You know, a number of years ago, I felt so strongly that God was putting on my heart a mantle to speak into the black community, black families, and so on, that I actually put together a very serious fact sheet called A Portrait of the Black Family. And to read that document and all of the facts, all of the persons that are cited in that document are black, all. Not a white person cited in it. Because I knew that if we put a white voice in there, it would be dismissed out of hand. So I urge you to get a copy of that. It's on our website, saveus.org. It's called A Portrait of the Black Family.
Okay.
It'll open your eyes, my friends, all of us. And I used that a number of years ago, bringing black pastors into our home. I knew them. I developed friendships with them. And I brought them into our home for 5 weeks of serious conversation, having a meal together, and when we would spend 5 weeks talking about what had happened in the black community and what we can do about it as pastors. Well, the interesting thing is that one pastor came out of there and used that fact sheet, and he said, I have found this fact sheet to be the most powerful tool I have ever found to preach righteousness and revival in the black family. He's a black pastor. But then I had another one. After 2 days, 2 evenings of this, he fell on his face in the room and was quiet for about 15 minutes. And he got up, and here's what he said. My family looks just like this fact sheet. Then on the other side of the room, there were about 12 of us, by the way. On the other side of the room, a pastor in the back leaned back in his chair, put his hands behind his head, kind of in frustration. And here's what he said. Unless we're willing to talk about this and do something about this in our families, we have no right to talk about this in our congregations. And guess what?
Yep.
All of the people left the next night except for three. They weren't willing to do anything.
Huh.
It was too tough to deal with.
Yeah, no, that's very significant because, I mean, and I write about this in chapter two. I wasn't raised with my father. And I got to know him a bit when I got older, and, you know, he tried to make amends, but, you know, he just wasn't committed to being a father. And so when I speak about this, I'm speaking from experience.
Are you a father?
I know what, I'm a father now, and I try to be the best father as I can.
How many children do you have?
I have 3 children.
And what are their ages?
So I have a 24-year-old, 21, and 18.
Okay. Well, they're all in a point where much of this has been formed in their minds and hearts. How do they respond to what they see out there in the workaday world, in the college or university or high school where they are?
Yeah, so we my wife is strong. I mean, she's been such a pillar for me. Mm. And so we tried to raise our kids. We call it from the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tried to form their characters in a way that they were solid. Mm-hmm. And again, we're not perfect, but we try to give them the sorts of values that when they go out into the world, they can navigate, right?
Yeah.
Because when people talk about race, which inevitably they do with our kids, and they're hearing things in school, I think our kids have a perspective that is fair.
Are they able to stand against the avalanche of this these racist viewpoints?
Well, they are, but, you know, I don't know if you have children, but I mean, if you...
Oh, yeah, I have 3 daughters, 10 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren.
That's right. So you know they have different personalities. So you have the shy one, you have the one who's confrontational, and then you have one who maybe is a mix of both. So our kids are the same way, and so we have the one who speaks up, we have the one who just wants to be left alone, and but I think all of our kids, all 3, they recognize what we value, and they don't want to disappoint us. It's not that we're telling them how to think, but they don't want to disappoint us. They feel like what we taught them is good, and so I think they're able to navigate. But I'm speaking from experience in terms of fatherlessness, and so I try to communicate that to our children, and I think that they recognize that when I speak about this, I'm speaking from the heart. I know what I went through.
Right. Well, brother, I appreciate your candor and your willingness to grapple with this. It takes a certain amount of holy boldness. From a Jewish perspective, you call it chutzpah.
That's right.
To be able to stand against the evil of racial division that's being intensified and intentionalized for lifting certain groups up for political power. And it's just it's very, very can you imagine God, creator, looking down at this and just wincing? I think the angels of heaven are weeping over what we have done and what we're continuing to do in dividing people. The book, friends, The Virtue of Color Blindness, it is a $30 hardbound book. It's yours for $15 on our website, saveus.org, saveus.org, where also you can find the Portrait of the Black Family fact sheet. We have a number of fact sheets there, but that's one that is very significant. It's the most extensive of all of them because it's extremely important. It really is. Be prepared to pray when you read it. And so also you can get the book by giving us a call, 1-800-SAVE-USA, or write to us at Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255, writing a check at $6 for postage and handling. So, Andre, very quickly, you talk about a kind of racism, sort of a comfortable racism. What's comfortable racism in 30 seconds?
So in 30 seconds, basically, it's sort of a middle-class exhaustion with the issue of race. So I think that most parents might say, hey, you know, our kids have been on the color.
I'm losing you now. I'm losing you completely. Friends, get a copy of the book, The Virtue of Color Blindness. Andre Archie, the author. God bless, be a blessing, and be in prayer about this situation and families.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Chrismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.